question of democracy in the world. And the speaker is Vic Lanny. So I'll hand you straight over to Vic.
Welcome, Chairman. Yesterday, we dealt with the difference between our concept of democracy and the one that's held by just about everybody else. For them, it's what we have today. That is, you've got the right to organise politically, where there's elections every 4 or 5 years, and the results, whatever they are accepted. Now, Danny mentioned yesterday, in passing, that in their concept of democracy, there's no economics democracy at all. And that's why a small group of people sitting in a boardroom halfway across the world, perhaps, can make decisions which will deprive a workforce, or even a whole community, of its livelihood, and they don't get a say in the matter. But we've got a wider concept of democracy than that, that's much, much more. Our view is that it will involve, and Richard outlined this very well, the whole community making decisions at every level in life. And anyway, even so, their limited political democracy is well worth having. And again, Richard made that point. And that's what I'll be referring to in the course of the rest of us meet this afternoon, that limited political democracy. So I'm not talking about what we have in mind, I'm talking about what they have in mind. Now, what is the condition of democracy today? Well, if you looked at the political map at the start of World War II in 1939, you'd have seen there was only about a dozen democracies in the entire world. And I've got to say, I was surprised when I realised that. Now, across the Atlantic, you had Canada and America, and south of that, in Central and South America, well, what you had was some nominal democracies. But from time to time, you did have elected governments. But they were always there, in the sufferance of the military. And even Chile, which was regarded as the South America's democratic showpiece, well, they come into that category, as well as we saw when Pinochet took over in 1973. And in the whole of the African continent, which had been carved up by the colonial powers, well, there was no democracy at all on that continent. And it's the same story in Asia, the exceptions being, of course, Australia and New Zealand. And even in Europe, which is, after all, the fount of modern political democracy, there was only a handful there too. You had Britain, France, Belgium, Holland and Denmark, Norway and Sweden. And if you can forget the fact that women didn't get the vote in Switzerland, you can throw that one in for good measure. But by the end of the war, 1945, there was only 7 democracies. The various dictatorships had done away with the rest of them. And it was expected, after the war, that there would be a big expansion in democracy, especially as independence movements were on the march all over the world. And for the next 25 years, well, the colonial powers lost most of their possessions. They were winkled out bit by bit. I think France was the most difficult one. And in some cases, they had to be pushed out. In other cases, they actually jumped before they get pushed. And these new nations come into being, and as often as not, they had a democratic constitution along with an elected government. But that didn't last long. And most of them degenerated into one-party systems or even military dictatorships. And the reason for this is because they simply were not ready for democracy. The conditions for democracy didn't exist. Now, we all know that every nation is an artificial creation. But even in Europe, that is true. But at least in many European countries, the population would have, to some extent, and I stress that, to some extent, a common culture, a common language, common religion, and again, to some extent, a shared sense of identity. Now, most of the colonies, or rather the ex-colonies, didn't have that. And what I've done is, I can't deal with them all, of course, hundreds of them. What I've done is I've picked out Nigeria, because what happened there is pretty typical of what happened in different parts of the world. And I chose it just to illustrate that point. Now, Nigeria had been a British possession, and tremendous ethnic differences, as could be shown by the fact they had over 250 different tribes in Nigeria. And they existed at greatly differing rates of political, social, and economic development. They had a multitude of languages and just as many religions. And the only thing that they ever had any unity on was they wanted to get rid of the British. So their loyalty, unlike some of the European population, was not to the nation. They didn't know what a nation was. Their loyalty was to the ethnic group or to the tribe. And just recently, in March there, the Nigerian military, who have ruled there for a long, long time, for the umpteenth time, they decided to hand back at least the trappings of power to the politicians. And elections were held. And the result was, according to the Guardian, that as expected, Nigerians largely voted along ethnic and regional lines. And that's 40 years after independence, remember. Nothing's changed there. Even so, there are more democracies in the world today. All the countries in Europe, which are listed to the dictators, have had it restored. And as far as I can see, it seems to be pretty well established in all of them. Now, as for the rest of the world, well, I've got to admit, Cumber Chairman, I simply didn't know. I hadn't been keeping up to date, perhaps, in the way that I should. So I needed some material to assist me in this matter. And a member supplied me with a list of book titles which may do that. And what I did was I picked out this one. It's a book by a man called Tatu Van Hannen. He's a political scientist, and according to the blurb, he's an expert in democracy, and he should be, because he's written 13 books on the subject. And the reason why I picked it was because of the title. Look at that. Prospects of Democracy, a study of 172 countries. That looked to be perfect for my requirements. Actually, it turned out to be a waste of money. Because, well, you know, it's a book written by an academic for the other academic, and it's full of tables and statistics, and he's got horrible writing style into the bargain. So it's not what you would call a good read. So the worst thing about the book is his criteria for determining what is a democracy is. Now, this expert has written these 13 books. His idea of democracy is, well, you've got more than one political party and elections. And on that basis, he picks out some very, very bizarre examples of democracy. One of them being Singapore. Now, I don't know if you see the headline there. Singapore chief pays the cost of opposition. And it deals with an opposition politician in Singapore, Chee Soon Juan. And he is a successor to a previous opposition leader who ended up serving 23 years in prison without trial and 4 years internal exile. He was freed in 1992, but not allowed to become involved in politics. He's still not tested the waters of a political comeback because he feels it's still not safe, despite the government's assurances. But this present day leader, there's a photograph of him there, Mr. Chee Soon Juan, he had to go to jail as well, because he had the damn cheek to organise a political rally without a permit. And for that, he ended up in jail. And to show you that the level of democracy that exists in Singapore, said with him in the dock is Wong Hong Toi, a party member, who did little more than adjust Dr. Chi's microphone a couple of times and hold on to a loudspeaker to prevent it falling from a lamppost. The police are investigating a third man who was caught on video applauding a little too enthusiastically for their liking. And when the elections come along, as they did here in February, the ruling party, which has been in office forever, they get 60% of the votes, but it gets 95% of the seats. What it did was it warned every constituency in Singapore, and really Singapore is just a city state, that if they didn't vote the right way, they would go to the bottom of the queue for things like schools, transport, housing, and the other social services. Now, I mention this just to show that there are not as many democracies in the world as some people would like us to think. Now, it's always been the party's case, well, I say always, for a very, very long time, that capitalism needs democracy. Now, unfortunately, I won't have the time to deal with that just now. Maybe in question time. Now, I noticed that this morning Peter Lawrence raised this point. So, capitalism needs democracy, we say. And yet, there's a big, big paradox here. Because capitalism, being the kind of system that it is, has got anti-democratic tendencies within it. Because every nation must pursue its own interests as it sees them, irrespective of other people's ideologies. And USA and Britain, and other democracies, they love democracy, but only within their own frontiers. They're not necessarily in favour of democracy anywhere else in the world. Now, for example, the United States of America is a very democratic country, in theory, at any rate. And some might say it's probably the most democratic country because access to information there is far superior to what it is, say, in this country. And the population have the access to the political process more than they have just about anywhere else. Although, unfortunately, only about 50% of them ever take advantage of it. So, despite all that, despite America's democratic bona fides, it would much rather deal with a compliant dictatorship that was sympathetic to American business interests than with a democratically elected government that was not. And in the past, they have helped, if not directly, certainly indirectly, they have helped to topple democratic governments, of which Chile is the latest example, and we'll be saying more about that later on. As soon as America is faced with what it considers to be a recalcitrant government, democratic or otherwise, it uses the local embassy and it sends in the CIA to subvert that government and try and have it replaced by one that it approves of. And if all of that isn't sufficient, then you can always send in the Marines, and you've done that many a time. I had thought of bringing along the testimony of a United States Marine General by the name of Smedley D. Butler, where he outlines from the beginning of the century up until he retired, very frankly, the role that he played in furthering American capitalism's interests in the Central and South America and in the Caribbean and even in the Pacific. He said, I'll just give you this wee bit, that he was far, far better than Al Capone. He said, Al Capone only operated in two districts in Chicago. He said, I operated in three continents. So it's a good idea if you get a hold of Smedley D. Butler's testimony. If anybody wants to get a hold of it, I could give them details. But Britain's involved in this dirty game too. We all know about his arms sales to those oppressive regimes throughout the world. It doesn't just give them arms, it gives them technical know-how, and it gives them their so-called security forces training in how to keep their thumb on the local population. And organisations like Amnesty, they howl at this, and they say, what about your pre-election pledge? Remember what you were saying before you got elected, that you would practice an ethical foreign policy? I'm sure that'll ring a bell some members of the audience. But this is capitalism. Isn't this some utopia we're living in? This is capitalism. And, you know, what can a government do in that context? Well, if it practices that ethical foreign policy that Labour were on about before the election day, the result would be that it would be lost arms sales. Lost arms sales mean lost British workers' jobs, and lost British workers' jobs mean lost votes. And in any case, even if Britain did give up selling arms and giving aid to these oppressive regimes, some other country would step in and supply the arms and know-how. Anyway, but there's more to democracy, of course, than just elections. I mentioned access to information just a few minutes ago there, and this has been very much in the headlines recently because of the publication of the government's draft Freedom of Information Bill, a draft which has produced almost universal condemnation. Once again, the government's been reminded about its pre-election promise. What about open government? The open government we were talking about before the election. And a Labour MP actually warned the government that it should remember that information is the oxygen of democracy. Now, you might think that sounds a wee bit pompous, but nevertheless, it's true. To the extent that information is withheld, to the same extent is democracy diminished. So the truth is, when all said and done, that as we live in capitalism, governments must have secrets. Of course they must. They must have secrets not only from other governments, they must have secrets from their own citizens. Any country that gave up its military and commercial secrets would be committing suicide. So all that talk about open government, just daft. But nevertheless, in Britain, secrecy is taken to extremes. In fact, people have said that what we have in this country, and I think they're right, is a culture of secrecy. Now, just earlier this year, I read a book. I didn't bring it along, fed up carrying things about. And it was a book about the history of the internment of enemy aliens, especially during World War II. And I was particularly interested in this because my own father was one of those enemy aliens who was rounded up in the middle of the night in 1940 and carted off to an internment camp. We never saw him for another year. And he was lucky. He was one of the fortunate ones. Because instead of spending his time in an internment camp in the Isle of Man, he could have been on the Arandora Star. That was a liner that was used to take internees just like him, and then it never done any harm in our lives, to Canada, and it repeated the great loss of life. But you see, he was one of the lucky ones. But the authors of the book, they said in the foreword, when they were trying to research their information They couldn't get access to the government place. That was denied to them. They wanted to know what the politicians were saying, what the civil servant mandarins were saying, what the police and the military were saying. But the files were withheld. And this was 40 years after the event, when all the people who were anybody and who were involved in that shabby episode were long since dead. But as I say, the files were withheld. And the really crazy thing about it, that's just to emphasise this culture of secrecy thing, secrecy for secrecy's sake. All the authors had to do to get the information was getting a plane over to America and get what they were looking for in American government files. Because, as I mentioned earlier, information is more easily accessible there. Now, I don't want you to think that because I've mentioned that twice, that means information in America can be had just for the asking. No, it's just a matter of degree. It's a wee bit easier in America than it is here. And to get to show you just how difficult it is to get information, just this very week, the United States State Department issued some of the files, and I stress that, some of the files, about the part that America played in overthrowing the Allende government. And that's after, 26 years. And one of the investigative reporters who was pursuing this matter, he said that the material released yesterday was the easy stuff. And he said the most explosive documents would be leaked over the next 6 months in an attempt to minimize their impact. So even there in America, where information is relatively easier to access, well, it's not that easy. But the good news is that there's growing resistance to all this secrecy. And it's not just coming from organizations like civil liberties and other concerned groups. It's because of the tremendously increased competition that there is within the media. In the past, the media only had to compete very limited way. For instance, the press only competed within itself and with the BBC and ITV. And the BBC and ITV, they had a virtual monopoly of the airwaves. And that's all changed now. Now, the press and BBC and ITV are faced with dozens of other TV channels and radio stations. And all of them, the whole lot of them, are engaged in a desperate scramble to get stories, to get scoops. And you know, they'll stop at nothing to get them. We've seen what they will do in order to get scoops. Nothing is sacred. Even the most sacred government secret. And if the journalists don't expose secrets, don't ferret them out, then there's a growing army of whistleblowers out there who will join in. And even the politicians are giving away their own government secrets, right up to cabinet level. All these leaks come from members of the government or members of the governing party so that they can sabotage, hopefully, for them, some government policy that they don't agree with. But there's another factor involved. It's not just their own competition from the media. It's the development of technology, a subject I've got to admit I'm really ignorant about. But even if the government did censor the press and TV, I know they hold on to some secret that it was determined to prevent the falling into the wrong hands. Well, my brother-in-law's got a Sky. Well, he didn't get it. Well, this he got it, the sports programmes. CNN is on that, and he tells me that in the middle of the night there's a multitude of the foreign language news programs, and they're all accessible for people who want them. But even if the government could censor them too, can't censor the internet. Now I've asked one or two party members who know a bit more about it than I do, and I wouldn't be saying much. And they say, no, they couldn't do it. So you see, secrecy is becoming harder and harder. Censorship is becoming harder and harder. So, okay, the government, not the government, I do need a thing. The media hates government censorship. It's not in their interest. What they want to do is be able to splash any story they want over their pages. But what about media censorship? For instance, people like John Pilger and the other Canadian journalists, they're always complaining about the untold stories. Pilger and others have been complaining about a lack of coverage of what's going on in the East Timor. And just recently, Pilger was and others, they were complaining about how the news about the Yugoslav war was so one-sided. Now, here I've got to take issue with Pilger and people like him. That's not necessarily due to censorship. It's just as likely to be due to commercial considerations, because a lot of these stories are left untold, they're not printed, and they're not broadcast. Well, that's because they won't sell papers, and they won't enhance viewing and listening figures. And then the main issue of the socialist standard, there's an article here, what the papers don't say, the tabloids, but they could just as easily have applied to the broadsheets, the so-called quality papers. And it quotes that obnoxious editor of the Daily Mirror, Piers Morgan. He explained the situation very clearly. He said, I only judge a story on what sells and what doesn't. So it's not necessarily censorship. But nevertheless, the press does censor. And who should know that better than us and the Socialist Party? We know all about that, because the press will defend to the death its right to publish, but it will also defend its right not to publish. In other words, that they can misquote, misrepresent, and tell lies about us, or anybody else for that matter. And we don't have a right to reply. But a very good recent example of that. But an even better example, I suppose, because it concerns a much wider issue, is what happened last year, I think it was, when Rupert Murdoch stopped a book being published by his publisher. A book that his publisher had commissioned, a book by Chris Patton, dealing with his time as the governor of Hong Kong. And, you know, Murdoch, for years now, had been sucking up to the Chinese government so that this will help him in extending his media empire into China. And the last thing he wants to do is to offend the Chinese government. So he wouldn't publish Patton's book, although they'd paid him something like 300,000 quid for it. But when he sent in a manuscript, some very harsh things to say about the Chinese government. Did it matter? No, it didn't matter, because the book got published anyway. Somebody else took it up and it sold even more copies than it otherwise would have, thanks to the oxygen of publicity that Murdoch had given it. And that's what always happens with censorship. The more you censor something, the more people want to get a hold of it. Now, I notice, Cumber Chairman, in your little synopsis here of what you imagine I'm going to say. You say that.
Well, I told you to say, you mean?
I should have phoned you, actually. To deal with capital, the economic aspect and the political aspect, both of them are changing their roles. Now, I don't know what you had in mind there, but what I will do is I will deal with threat from capital to democracies. As I see it, now, it used to be that in capitalist business, the big fish swallowed up the small fry. But now, the process of the concentration of capital has gone on to such an extent, you know, that there's bigger and bigger economic units and fewer of them. Now, the big fish are swallowing up one another. Giants are swallowing up one another, either by takeovers or by merging one way and another. They get together. And the bigger that they get, well, obviously, they're going to have more clout. They're going to be able to influence governments more than ever. But the question arises now, can they dictate to governments? Now, the left wing, of course, have always said yes. In fact, how many times have those of us who have been around long enough heard left wingers say, the decisions aren't made in Parliament, they're made in the boardrooms. And so incidentally, this man, he says the same thing. Michael Moore, I never miss one of his programmes. I think he's marvellous. I'm a great fan of Michael Moore. He's the TV satirist. He's a scourge of corporate America. And what he does is, he exposes what business does to its workers, the horrible conditions and the wages, and he does it. He also exposes how they pollute the environment and so on. And he does it with great humour, wonderful originality. He could teach us a thing or two, I'll tell you. And he does it with great courage, because I certainly wouldn't put myself in the positions that he puts himself in. Of course, he doesn't attack capitalism from our standpoint. He attacks it from a moral standpoint. And the kind of thing that he does is he'll go into the office of the founder of Nike, saw it on TV, and he'll say to him, look, you made so many billions last year. Would you be satisfied with just half of that? And then you can give the other half to the workers. Yeah? Because he sees what capitalism does and being down to greed. We see it as being down to necessity. We see that capital has got to seek out the highest return that it possibly can. But he sees the big threat to American democracy as coming from the lobbyists. Perhaps you've heard of them. They're a big, big feature of the American political scene. And what do? They're very highly skilled public relations people. They represent either corporations or even entire industries. For example, lobbyists will represent, say, General Motors or the oil industry or the National Rifle Association. In fact, and that last coin paper called the Gun Lobby. And their job is to push the arms of politicians, cajole them, and bribe them to vote for legislation which will be to the benefit of their client, corporation, or the industry. Or, alternatively, to repeal already existing legislation which their client thinks acts against their interests. And because of the activities of these lobbyists, which if you're an elect, of course, Moore says, look, don't bother America voting for the congressmen and the senators. They're just the middlemen. Vote for the people who have got the real power. Vote, skip the candidates. Vote for the lobbyists. Because according to him, they call the shots. He says, if Toto could pull back the curtain of Congress for us, what we would see is a bunch of powerful men who are pulling the levers. These wizards of Oz in Washington are called lobbyists. So he creates to them very, very great powers. Indeed, now he's saying that, I think, vote for the lobbyists with his tongue in his cheek. But there can't be any question about it. Business, lobbyists or not, have got influence the government. Of course they have. They must have it. They'll stop to think that they don't. And to prove that, you've only got to go and look and see currently how the American government is going to bat for Monsanto over the genetically modified crops. The American government, this for some time now, has been pressuring, bullying governments all over the world to give Monsanto a clear run here. And you've also only got to remember back a couple of months ago how the American government backed the United Fruit Company in that banana war. Remember that? Where it was prepared to have a trade war with its ally, the European Union, because the United Fruit Company resented the fact that the European Union was given special treatment to some of its ex-colonies, the banana producers in the Caribbean. The United Fruit Company, which already had probably the share of the world's market bananas, once more. So anyway, Michael Moore is wrong. Okay, as I say, the lobbyists and the clients have got clout, no question about that. But ultimately, when it comes down to it, as the politicians who have got the power, and they get it from the only place it can come from, and that is the electorate. Unfortunately, it's the apathy and indifference of the electorate that allows the lobbyists and the politicians to have the free hand in the way that they've got. Now, Cumber Chairman, I've complained in the past about some members who have been to the schools. I remember me complaining about how speakers took up too much time and they didn't allow enough time for the audience, questions and discussion. Now, I'm not about to preach one thing and practice another thing. And unfortunately, I've not had time to deal with quite a few things relating to democracy. For instance, what about Islamic fundamentalism? Well, what a barrier that poses to the emergence of democratic movements in those parts of the world where the fundamentalists hold sway. Just think what they're trying to do with regard to women. They really want to turn the clock back there, aren't they? And again, I've not had time to deal with this proposition, which some members might want to know more about, some members of the audience, members of the party or not. And that is, why is democracy good for capitalism? And then we come to another issue. And this might be what Ron had in mind when he wrote that wee blurb. What about the global market? Is that a threat to democracy? George Soros thinks that it is. In fact, he's on record as saying that the free market and the movement of the finance could possibly split capitalism asunder. And George Soros, he wants to save capitalism from itself. Now, we could go into that. Now, the audience might think of other things which I haven't even mentioned, never, let alone even dealt with. But despite all the obstacles that are placed in the path of democracy, democracy will increase. Not because capitalism needs it, that's a side issue. It will increase because wherever the people have been given a choice between remaining in an undemocratic legality or opting for the democracy that will give them the freedoms that they all want, have always gone for democracy. Of course, as I say, democracy's got its limitations, and when people who have been denied democracy ultimately get a hold of it, then very often they are disappointed with the results. They didn't get what they thought it would bring them. But that's not because democracy has failed. It's simply because the people, the working class, have failed to use democracy in the way that they should. Now, as I say, we can argue about this maybe. Could be that democracy is good for capitalism. But as Richard pointed out yesterday, absolutely vital for us. Our task is difficult enough. Think what it would be like if we didn't have political democracy. Those of you who have read the reports that circulate within the party relating to the plight that our new comrades in the Gambia face in an undemocratic legality, you know exactly what it is that I'm driving at.